Today's show is sponsored by Talkspace, the online therapy company that enables you to improve your mental health from anywhere at any time. Get matched with a licensed therapist from over 2,000 choices and message them whenever you need to. No commutes and no judgment. For a special offer for our listeners, visit Talkspace.com/freak, that's F-R-E-Q, and use the code FREAK to get $45 off your first month and show your support for this show. Talkspace, it's therapy for how we live today.
So I'm going to do the chant of making right now. The chant of making is... Ananathrak, Uthvas Bethad, Dohiel Dienve. And
that is so amazing. Yeah. Welcome to Feminist Frequency Radio. This is episode 20. I'm your host, Anita Sarkeesian, and I'm joined by my very own Gunter Klan, Carolyn Pettit.
Hey, hey.
And the Aster Disaster herself, Ebony Aster.
What's up, everybody?
This is the show that asks you to be critical of the media you love, or alternatively, we're the feminist killjoys coming for your media, depending on your perspective. On today's show, we're going to be talking Ready Player One. Well, really, Carolyn will be talking about it, and we'll be reacting in horror. Then we will dive into the newly released Roseanne reboot. As always, we'll finish the show by each sharing a little something in What's Your Freakout? Exclusively for our fantastic drip backers, we'll be recording a bonus segment. This week, we'll be talking about the kinds of media that Ready Player One left out of its sloppy nostalgia pudding. Everything Feminist Frequency produces, including this very podcast, is listener, reader, and fan-supported. Thank you for helping us stay on the air and on the web. If you want access to special perks and exclusive backer awards, join our podcast community at d.rip/femfreak. Now on with the show. What's up, y'all?
Hey, hey.
Hey.
I feel like we haven't done this in a while.
It does feel that way.
I mean, we did.
Yeah.
We've been releasing podcasts.
We sure have.
I think I just kind of miss Ebony.
Yeah.
That's probably what's going on.
But don't tell Ebony that, though.
No. It'll be our secret.
I won't say a word. But I know you love being in the room with me so that you can see me react in real time when you say some of your patented Anita bullshit about
It's true. I have a lot of patented Anita bullshit.
Yeah.
It's just, you know.
It comes in every flavor.
All right, Carol, what do you got for us in entertainment news this week?
Oh, God, I wish you hadn't asked. John Crickfalusi, often referred to as John Kay, the creator of Ren and Stimpy, you know, it's probably what he's best known for. There was a truly harrowing, like truly, truly hard to read piece in BuzzFeed this past week about his history with underage girls, and this being like very much throughout his riding high on Ren and Stimpy and other projects, like a totally open secret in that world. And I'll just read like a really brief excerpt from the BuzzFeed piece. The male artists who he'd worked with said stories of how Crickfalusi sexually harassed female artists, including teenage girls, were known throughout the industry. It's always been there, Mora said, another artist. Moreover, Crickfalusi made his fixation on teenage girls plainly obvious in his art, even as he worked on animated projects for the likes of Cartoon Network, Fox Kids, and Adult Swim. In an interview with Howard Stern in the mid-90s, the radio host asked him about a character in the comic book anthology the cartoonist was then promoting. Stern called the character Sody Pop, quote, a hot chick with big cans and nice legs. Crickfalusi responded with a smile, she's underage too.
Oh.
I mean, and that's like, truly the article. I mean, I think it's important that this be exposed, and I'm so, and the women who have come forward with their stories of how Crickfalusi sort of, he took advantage of them in the sense that these were young, like 13-year-old girls who loved Ren and Stimpy, you know, envisioned a future in animation, and he, absolutely abused that, like, admiration and interest in animation to sexually, like, manipulate them, and, I mean, it's sick.
Oh, geez, so, fucking horrifying.
So really a sad and unfortunate
story. I have, like, I have sort of warm memories of Ren and Stimpy. Like, we grew up on that, like, shitty adult.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Beavis and Butthead and Ren and Stimpy. And, like, you know, that was just kind of around when we were growing
up. Yeah,
and
you felt kind of edgy.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah. Now I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
Oh. You know, I have to say, like, I liked Ren and Stimpy, like, the characters and stuff. But the actual art itself, I always found just a little bit unsettling. And I get that that was the point. But it was hard for me to look at for some reason. You know, like, it just... There was a kind of like visceral grossness to it that made me always feel a little bit weird. So now I feel A+ completely justified in flipping the channel, having not known this until this weekend. But fuck you, John Kay.
Yeah, seriously. Fail. That seems so not serious enough.
Appropriate. Yeah, not quite strong enough.
I'm going to retract that.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just looking at the topics this week and being like, wow, this whole podcast is going to be a fucking nightmare shit show.
Yeah,
just like awful crap.
Yeah.
Sorry, y'all. Well, let's move on to the first topic, which is Ready Player One.
Yeah.
Carol, why don't you introduce the movie book disaster?
Certainly. So,
good night, Anita.
All right. Ready Player One is a new film directed by Steven Spielberg, based on a novel, if you can call it that, by a writer named Ernest Cline, and we've discussed it to some degree on the podcast before. You know, it's a story about a grim future in which people all escape into this virtual world where of possibility called the Oasis, and the creator of the Oasis, who has now died, when he died, left behind this contest to find an Easter egg, which would grant the person who finds it basically control over the Oasis and like tremendous wealth and everything. And it's about this young man named Wade Watts, or Parzival in the Oasis, who is one of millions of people who goes on the quest to find the Easter egg, and it's all about like having just an encyclopedic knowledge of like pop culture minutiae and trivia and stuff like that, you know, in order to win the game, which of course Parzival ultimately does. Has, you know, and that's the big happy ending. So that's it in short. Now, before I get into talking about the film, like, I want to say a little bit about fandom myself. And, like, so right now, as I'm sitting here recording this, I'm wearing a shirt from the exclusive Stranger Things collection available only at the high-end boutique known as Target. There's an image of like kids on bikes. And it's obviously like a kind of homage to stuff like E.T. And in fact, Stranger Things in its entirety is very deliberately Spielbergian. You know, it's about like childhood wonder and things like that. And,
it's a good shirt.
And on the show, right, there are nods to big things like the Ghostbusters, you know, in this season, like the kids all dress up as Ghostbusters for Halloween. But it's great to me as somebody who grew up with Ghostbusters, like, because it's not about just Ghostbusters itself as like a piece of branding. It's about their shared love of it and how it brings them together. And they do this fun thing on Halloween and stuff like that. Same with like this arcade game Dragon's Lair. It's not just like some hollow, like, here's this thing you remember. It's them like playing it together and bonding. And it's really about their friendship with each other and their connections with each other. Interestingly, Ready Player One reminds me perhaps most in a way of a film from some years ago called Super 8, which was directed by J.J. Abrams. And that film to me felt like a hollow attempt by J.J. Abrams to ape Spielberg. Like, he was obviously trying to do the Spielberg thing, but it just to me felt soulless. Ready Player One feels like Spielberg trying to mimic Spielberg and it being soulless.
Damn.
So I have a number of things, criticisms and stuff, things about the movie specifically that I want to talk about. But
so, just so everybody knows, Carolyn was the only one that went to see the movie.
Yeah, I took the bullet for the team on this one.
You did. You really did jump in front of that bullet, and I thank you because you were
and
only
read
a,
the book.
Yeah,
right. You were only a week away from retirement. You
That's
shouldn't
right.
Have had to do this, but I thank you.
So at the theater where I saw the film, before the film, there is this kind of featurette that with Ernest Cline, and he has this car, like he has an actual, he bought a real DeLorean, Ernest Cline did.
Ugh.
And then he slapped like a Ghostbusters logo on the side of the DeLorean. There's like technology stuff, references to this movie called Buckaroo Banzai in the DeLorean and everything. And to me, as like a fan of like, I like Back to the Future well enough. I really liked Ghostbusters when I was a kid, etc. Like, I'm looking at this and it's upsetting to me because it's like it feels less like celebrating these things and more like stripping them for parts, like take this thing, slap it on here. So to him, and the movie and the book are an extension of this, it's just about like the stuff, it's just about like the things themselves. But what, to me, when you separate them from the stories and the characters, they become meaningless. Like, it's so it's really upsetting to me. But let me quickly go through all the references in the film that I was able to catch while also trying to eat a chicken sandwich. So this is...
This should be a recurring segment.
Like. Yeah, yeah. And so I'm actually, later today, I'm going to go watch one of those videos on YouTube of like, all the references you missed in Ready Player One, and there will probably be like 5,000 things that I didn't see. But let me just quickly go through the things that I did see.
Is this like your version of that bonus episode in the book?
Right, where it's just like a list of yeah. I mean, I didn't catch that much stuff, but I'm going to do the best I can. Okay. The band The Police, there's a woman quickly wearing a Synchronicity album t-shirt. Minecraft, RoboCop, Marvin the Martian, Batman, both like a modern, serious, grim, dark Batman, and like the 1960s TV show Batman in the form of the Batmobile, Freddy Krueger, StarCraft, Simon, the little beepy gadget that Ralph Baer invented. Donkey Kong Jr., Star Trek, Buckaroo Banzai, Battlestar Galactica, New Order, Battletoads. Battletoads is such a weird one to me because Battletoads are like this kind of... I mean, there were good games, like 8 and 16-bit games about the Battletoads, but like today... There aren't like diehard Battletoads fans. I mean, there's way more like diehard Sonic fans, and there's no Sonic the Hedgehog stuff in this because they obviously didn't get any Sega licenses or anything. So it's just like weird. Like, why are the fucking Battletoads in here? Like, it just seems strange. Like, you can tell that, oh, it's all about like what they were able to get the license to.
Yeah.
Saturday Night Fever, Defender.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. There's a big Saturday Night Fever reference.
Huh. Was that in the book as well?
No. This is purely
interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
So Defender, the arcade game, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Robotron, The Breakfast Club, Beetlejuice, Mortal Kombat, Alien, Superman, The Dark Crystal, Citizen Kane,
what?
Ferris Bueller.
Citizen okay, Kane, sorry. Yeah. I'm gonna stop interrupting you. Go.
Okay. No. Ferris Bueller, Mad Max, Michael Jackson, but like not. In a way that he just like not in a real way, but there's like a Duran Duran, The Fly, the movie with Jeff Goldblum, Say Anything, The Shining, what are they called? The Joy Division album cover for Unknown Pleasures. It's a very popular meme-y t-shirt even today with all the lines that look like mountains on it. Wonder Woman, Centipede. The arcade game, Sword Quest, the Atari game, the movie Excalibur. This is an interesting, the way they do this reference is sort of interesting. So in the movie Excalibur, there's a magic spell that Merlin and Morgana use, like whenever they're casting magic, they have this very specific chant that they do. And I actually know the chant by memory because I've seen Excalibur so many times.
It goes, oh my God.
Yeah, so I'm going to do the chant of making right now. The chant of making is Ananathrak Uthvas Bethad Dohiel Dienve. And,
that is so amazing.
Yeah, and that chant is a magic spell in the Oasis to activate like a very powerful artifact.
Would you win the Easter egg if you were in the Oasis?
There's a chance. I think I'd have a pretty good shot.
I would put you up as Feminist Frequency team leader.
Thank you. Thank you.
Absolutely.
It's a job I've been preparing for my whole life. Nancy Drew gets a throwaway mention. Of course, we all know the Iron Giant is besmirched by its appearance in this film. The very important Atari 2600 game Adventure, which, you know, it is an interesting piece of video game history that it had an Easter egg, the very first Easter egg in it. And I, you know, I appreciate that the film treats that, like, fairly well. Halo, Chucky from Child's Play, Mechagodzilla, Gundam, almost done. Mario Kart, Lady Hawk, Rush, the band.
Oh, God. I'm so glad I didn't go to see the movie.
Yeah. Krull, T2, Twitch, if you can call that like a property, War Games, Pac-Man, and yeah, that's it. That's all. So, but I'm sure that that's just, like I said, I'm sure there's, oh, at one point too, I briefly caught a glimpse in the background of a, in the Oasis of like a, you know, like a restaurant or bar or something that I'm pretty sure, it was only on screen briefly, I'm pretty sure it was called Ratner's, which would be a reference to,
oh God,
really gross filmmaker Brett Ratner. So if so, that's gross. Okay.
So
yeah,
what
go
did
ahead.
You think of the movie?
Loved it. No. It's extraordinarily hollow. Like, it is utterly and deeply frustrating. Like, let me talk specifically about like a few of my frustrations with the film. There's the female character. Well, there's a few female characters, but like the girl that Wade like gets in the end, Artemis, or in the real world, her name is Samantha. So she has a birthmark on her face. Okay. It's a subtle birthmark. It's not even like a port wine birthmark or anything like that. And she's like by dominant cultural beauty standards, she's very, very attractive. But she's like afraid when Wade meets her that he's going to be disappointed in when he sees how she looks. And so he sees how she looks and he's like, I'm not disappointed. And it's like, it's not about Artemis. It's a moment about playing up, oh wow, Wade is this man, this young man who, he's obviously in love with her soul because he doesn't mind that she has this like subtle birthmark on her face. And it's like, are you kidding me? Like, we're supposed to think this guy is so great, that he sees so far past superficial elements that, you know, he doesn't care about this. It's like, as I just find stuff like that really insulting. Like, you know, if you want to make some kind of statement, or if you, you know, about that, why not cast an actor in a role who actually doesn't really fit, like, cultural beauty standards, right? You know? That was really frustrating.
You know what's really interesting about that particular note, Caro, is that, okay, so I haven't read Ready Player One, but I have read that cramazing poem that Ernest Klein wrote.
Yes, yes.
About, I think it's called Nerd Porn Auteur,
where
he essentially, tries to posit that objectifying women with glasses, essentially, you know, like smart girls,
yes, exactly,
is somehow new and noteworthy as opposed to the beer swilling alpha males who reside in sports bars,
yes,
who only
exactly.
like pneumatic titted, you know,
yes.
beach blonde chicks.
Yeah.
And what I love about the reaction to that poem, which I think is like 7 years old now, if not slightly older, is people coming out of the woodwork to be like, hey, surprise, Ernest Klein, you're not doing anything new here. Also, P.S., you're still objectifying these women. But yeah, just this idea that like in the construction of, you know, this movie and in the underlying love story, it's absolutely vital that the protagonist receives a trophy in the form of
yes.
a hot chick.
Yes.
You know?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And it's frustrating too because Artemis is such a more interesting character than Wade. Like, I'm watching the film and I'm like, oh, she like is trying to lead some kind of resistance. Like, she's actually trying to like do something about the crippling poverty and economic imbalance in this world. And, you know, Wade is this bland white guy, like, but of course he has to be the center of the film. Go ahead.
Oh, I no.
Oh, okay.
I just want to talk about gatekeeping.
Yes. So I'm glad you mentioned gatekeeping. Interestingly, in the film, There's the sort of most traditional, like really overt example of what might be, you know, what we might often consider gatekeeping is actually, and I think this, like they did this deliberately, the screenwriters, is actually like initiated by Artemis. Like she is the one who tests Wade. She's like, you know, early on in their having met, she's like, you know, what was Halliday's favorite shooter? You know, Goldeneye. What mode? This mode, like playing as what character? Odd Job. You know, so
do
she's
they do all that in the movie.
Oh yeah,
oh, this sounds so embarrassing.
So and it's totally gatekeeping. You know, but yeah, but here it's like, oh,
so,
it's the girl
yeah,
doing
so that's
it.
Interesting. So one of the reasons, like we've talked about this before, but I like it is so troubling that this movie exists today in a post-Gamergate
yeah.
world. I'm saying that, although that's not
there's
over,
a great and there's
I mean?
A great Vox piece actually that's all about how post-Gamergate, like, we cannot look at this anymore as just like a fun pop culture romp.
Yeah, exactly. And why it's so frustrating that this was even made, because like geek culture there's such a toxic underbelly of it that yeah. created this space, the gatekeeping of this, of these folks who think that they own
right.
fandom and they own geekdom became violent.
Yes.
Like incredibly violent. And it still is.
Yeah.
And so the fact that a movie was made that celebrates that gatekeeping that leads to violence
mm-hmm.
is really frightening to me.
Yeah.
And like the fact that what you're saying is that they know enough to know
yeah.
to make it the woman doing the gatekeeping in the film.
Yes.
Right? Where, like, they know that there's an issue here, and they know that there's, like, gender dynamics happening here. And so, like, fuck you.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you know, if you know that much, you know about the rest of the hostility in
yes.
this space as well.
Exactly. And it's also deeply frustrating to me that, okay, so the book obviously... the book presents the Oasis for all the conflict in it over the Easter egg. It's basically a place where people, you know, abide by the social contract. There's no mention whatsoever of like sexual harassment or racism running
yeah.
prevalent in that space at all. Nor is there ever any mention of like, oh, well, Halliday creating the Oasis, he learned lessons from other places. And so he built in these safeguards. Like it just sort of assumes like, oh, people in a space like this would behave. And to me, that's such a obviously a privilege, like only a white man based on his experiences on the internet could envision an online world where like you don't even have to think about those things
right.
because
mm-hmm.
You know, recently, very recently, you know, that there was this thing launched called like VR chat or something like that, and it's like super bare bones and basic, but in superficial ways, it's similar to the Oasis. People go in VR, they go to this space shared with other people. They can appear however they want to appear. And a lot of people do appear as, for instance, Sonic the Hedgehog characters and shit like that. And the place ran, you know, so rampant with racism and misogyny mm-hmm. that, you know, I mean, it became a huge news story. I mean, there was actually a specific, deeply racist, like horrifying meme called Ugandan Knuckles being a Sonic character, where, you know, these people dressed up as a misshapen kind of caricature of Knuckles would make like really racist stereotype, you know, like click noises and things like that with their voice just to be fucking racist as shit. Like you know, that was a thing that spread throughout VR chat. And the Oasis doesn't account, you know, I wish the film at least had been like, you know, it just could even be like a throwaway line, like Halliday saw that, you know, people don't always behave themselves in these spaces, and so he had to build in restrictions that accounted for this and this and this and this, like so that we can at least believe that, you know, that all these people are interacting with each other in ways that, again, like honor the social contract and that aren't like extraordinarily vile.
Yeah.
One of the
yeah.
things that is incredibly interesting to me about our modern cultural moment is the way in which it kind of refuses or its major actors refuses to concede any time or legitimacy or importance. And what I mean by that is, there was a way in which up to this point in human history, you know, there would be, you know, new art you know, perpetually created, and, you know, new mythologies that gain currency. But eventually everything sort of, you know, passes away, right? Because you can't hold on to everything at once. But in this moment, we can access so much past history that we're kind of stuck in nostalgia, and often stuck in someone else's nostalgia, right? Yeah. So you have the fever dream of a 45-year-old white man, and it's like, no, I refuse to let anything else be important than the things I loved when I was 12 years old, and you will just have to fucking deal, you know? And it doesn't matter that my experience of the 80s as a black girl nerd is almost completely different than his. The definition of being a true nerd, a true geek, like the true Scotsman, you know, is someone else's definition, right? And so there is a very interesting piece that I just read this morning, and we'll put the link in the show description, that was published on BuzzFeed, about how this movie is like an kind of an unintended horror film in a way, because you're stuck in this moment of nostalgia, right? Like there's no kind of forward movement. It's always like you have to continue to talk about Spielberg and continue to talk about Blade Runner and continue to talk about Alien and continue to talk about these things. And it's like, okay, cool, but what are the things that are currently happening? You know, what about more recent history? You know, like there's only so much space in the brain for it, and we just continue to eat at the same fucking white man's table. I'm tired.
Today's show is sponsored by Talkspace, the online therapy company that lets you message a licensed therapist from anywhere at any time. You know what's cool about that? So you know how like you go to therapy and it's once a week and like it's a great experience, or sad or whatever, you might cry it's in your car for an
beneficial.
Hour
afterwards. It's whatever. Helpful. Yeah.
Yeah. But like your emotional life doesn't exist based on like once a week interactions.
Exactly.
So sometimes you're having a really shitty night, and sometimes you're having like some big crisis that happens. And like, it's kind of cool that you can just text your therapist.
Exactly. Just having that freedom to reach out, you know, anytime, and know that someone qualified is going to be there for you. It's such a great feeling. It kind of takes a weight off your shoulders.
Yeah, for real. Like you can, it's, or even if you're like at the office or out or wherever you might be, you can just text a trained therapist. And it's, so with Talkspace, your therapist is your therapist. So you're texting the same person who knows your history and knows your story. And I think that's really cool.
It sure is. I mean, it's, you know, emotional struggle does not wait for your Tuesday at 5 p.m. Therapy appointment.
Exactly. So please check out Talkspace.com/freak, and you can use the code freak to get $45 off your first month and show your support for this show if you're interested in giving this a try. All right, let's move on to another horror show.
Okay.
Oh, God.
So, Roseanne was rebooted, and
I don't think reboot is the right word. I think it's just a continuation.
Sure, that's fair.
Yeah.
Okay, Exhumed?
I want to start with talking about how and why the original series was so important before we go into what is happening now.
Important to whom? Is a question
important
we should
to
also
the history of television.
Mm-hmm.
I will stake my claim here. I will totally die on this hill. The show ran from 88 to 97. And in the context of television at the time, Roseanne pushed a lot of boundaries that were not pushed. So it doesn't mean that it was important to everyone of all time, but it is a important historical document in the history of television landscape and in the history of representation in television, I would argue.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a number of reasons for it. So one, you have a working class family that is actually dealing with genuine, like it's a sitcom, but they're dealing with genuine concerns of a working class family in terms of not being able to keep the bills on, not being able to afford food, not, you know, all of those kinds of things. They're not like a traditional, like beautiful TV family, right? Like there are fat characters, there are like, The other thing that it did was it introduced several gay and lesbian characters. And at the time, that was not a thing that happened on mainstream television, especially not a show that was really popular. There were stories behind the scenes about Roseanne who actually fought for having certain messages and certain things on the show that like the executives didn't want. And she like like she threw fits behind the scenes to make it happen. The show was fairly progressive within the constraints of what it could be on television, right? And I loved it. Mm-hmm. Like, I've rewatched the original Roseanne series several times since it's aired, and it ended in 97. The last season is a fucking dumpster fire nightmare that nobody wants to talk about. Although I think the season finale was a really, really smart season finale, trying to make up for how disastrous the last season was. So when they announced a new Roseanne, or like a continuation or whatever the fuck this thing is, I was actually kind of horrified, because I feel like Roseanne is in this really particular time capsule of importance in television history, and I want it to just sit there and be that, right? Like, we can have that in the past, and now we have lots of shows with queer characters. Like, that's not, you know, lots, whatever. We have more. It's a little more accepted. Roseanne herself has lost her fucking mind and become like a super whack job conspiracy theory, transphobic, like conservative nightmare who's literally attacked our friends on Twitter, right? Like, and so when they said that the show was coming back, it seemed like a disaster waiting to happen. And I would argue that it is. So there's my spiel.
Okay. So I'll say my reaction to the first two episodes is that in a lot of ways they're very, very good, and that makes it all the worse, because what you have, so I'm like, oh, this feels familiar, this feels like the Connors, the living room, yes, this is what their living room would feel like 20 years later, all of this, you know, and oh, they have this gender nonconforming grandson, and like, but Roseanne, you know, and Dan, like, they come around and like they embrace the kid, and so, and you know, people at home can have like the warm fuzzy, like, oh, they're not trans, you know, they're not transphobic people, they love this kid or whatever, and so Roseanne's character on the show is a Trump supporter, and so what this does is, you know, it lets people, viewers, feel like, oh, there are good-hearted, on like Trump supporters out there who, you know, love their families and are just, you know, working hard, and who, you know, aren't like transphobic or racist. They look, they have this cute like black granddaughter who they love or whatever.
Yeah, what the fuck was that? She was there for like 2 seconds.
And so, like, the problem with this is like they present, you know, the conflict between Laurie Metcalf, who was a Clinton character, who was a Clinton supporter, and, you know, Roseanne, who was a Trump supporter, is just like a difference of opinion that we can, like, mm-hmm. come together over. And what nobody on the show does, at least yet, is force, you know, Roseanne to confront, like you voted for a president who, you know, if this kid, Mark, it continues to be gender nonconforming. I mean, he's, you know, you voted for a president who was going to create so much more hate and restrictions and, like, you know, just fomenting that shit. Your black granddaughter, you voted for a white supremacist, period. You voted for a white supremacist. Like, why doesn't, what's Laurie Metcalf's character's name?
Jackie.
Why doesn't Jackie fucking say that? Like, you know, and so, like, there's still this part of me, because there are people like Wanda Sykes involved in the show, and we're only two episodes
in. Wanda Sykes is involved in the
show? Yeah. And so I'm like, okay, please, somewhere, you know, along this season, like, really turn the knife. Like, make the viewers at home who feel like, oh, you know, I voted for Trump, I'm a nice person. Look, Roseanne shows that, like, people who voted for Trump can be nice people and who don't want to confront, like, the actual consequences of their actions in the voting booth. You know, like, I really hope the show twists the knife on those people at some point this season. Go ahead.
I want this show to get canceled after that. I found these two episodes almost impossible to watch. Like, I didn't laugh once. And part of it is that there's been very little movement, deliberately so, in terms of the construction and the characterization of this show, both visually, emotively, etc. So the set is the same. The people mm-hmm. are the same, to the point where we get both Beckys, right? And so there was a very alienating moment as I was watching this, when I realized I'm not the same person who watched sitcoms in the 80s and 90s. I don't watch a lot of regular, you know, sitcoms anymore. Sure. And I thought, oh, we've moved past this. But then I thought, no, I might have moved on to something else. But, you know, the viewing public as a whole certainly has not. I mean, we have Chuck Lorre and his career to prove otherwise, right? Like, there's definitely an audience for these kinds of sitcoms.
A huge yeah, audience. You know?
But I found it very interesting that Roseanne Conner, her character's support of Trump seems very passive, right? And it seems very part and parcel with her kind of contrarian spirit. It doesn't seem as if Roseanne Conner, not Roseanne Barr, but Roseanne Conner's embrace of Trump and her voting for him has anything to do with anything more than kind of being a contrarian. Whereas Jackie, flaky life coach Jackie, tries to suggest, like, here's why I wanted to vote for Clinton, right? And she has, like, actual things that she's concerned about. And so I found it very interesting that nevertheless, the audience is supposed to, you know, kind of embrace Roseanne and her passive support of Trump versus, like, Jackie's kind of active support for Clinton, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was a great tweet I saw, and I'm sorry that I don't remember who tweeted it, but it's essentially said, you know, people are praising Roseanne for supposedly, quote unquote, showing both sides on a network that refused to air the Blackish episode about kneeling athletes.
Yeah. Yeah. And give me a fucking break. Like, Roseanne, because you hug and kiss your black granddaughter, in the opening credits, you're supposed to get, you know, like a free pass. Give me a fucking break. You can like individual black people and still be racist as fuck. Ask slave owners. Kiss my ass. This show, I hated it. I felt like it was a full Killmonger moment, you know? Like, I really all of these people talking about how great it was, and I was like, this y'all show, this was awful. I could not take it.
I like, even Carolyn, you were saying, and Roxane Gay wrote a piece in the New York Times being like, it's really funny, but the politics are bad. And I'm like, was it funny? Because I didn't feel like it was funny. I also like I think John Goodman and Laurie Metcalf are
too really, good for this
really
show.
Great actors in life in general.
Yeah.
In everything that they do. And everyone else was fucking excruciating. And they were also excruciating on the show because they're not given a lot of material. Like, I felt like, you know, like the original Roseanne was not like a super well acted show, right? Like,
Roseanne has always been a lousy actor.
Yeah. And like a lot of the characters and a lot of the actors on that show, like, that's not why you watch it. And so, one, we've come so far in television from the early 90s, the late 80s, early 90s to today. TV has transformed in terms of quality. And so, like, watching it was also just like these one-off punchline. I think it's kind of actually what Ebony was saying in terms of, like, I've moved on from the sitcom format.
But that's, I mean, I think that the sitcom format, like, is not irrelevant. Like, I think that you can absolutely still have sitcoms that comment meaningfully on the world in which we live.
And they can also be done well. So, like, there was a show that was, like, one season that was a sitcom called Up All Night, and I fucking loved it. I thought it was brilliant, and I thought it was really, really smart. And it was done well, right? Like, there are ways to... So, Roseanne is very much of what it was before.
Yeah.
Which was never really great in terms of, like, quality television. So coming back to it, I'm like... But it felt hollow, right? Like... Here's the thing, too, that I've been kind of grappling with is, like, okay, I would have a problem with any show that's about being Trump supporters in general, but I probably wouldn't watch it, right? Like, I wouldn't even know about it, right? Because I don't watch sitcoms. It's not a part of my, like, cultural environment generally. But Roseanne used to be a show that was slightly progressive, that was liberal, that, like, you know, pushed the boundaries in a way that, like, we could be get down with, at least to some degree, right? And the fact that this show, like, Roseanne, the legacy of Roseanne is now trying to be this centrist bullshit, I think is what is really, really hard for me to grapple with, right? Like,
the show starts with them having to share medicine. You have these two, you know, people who are Roseanne and Dan are what, early 60s? I'm assuming. Yeah. They both have, you know, tons of health issues. They're sitting there fucking rationing their medicines. Yeah. And I'm like, y'all, are you for real not going to do something with this? Like if they had
I think just the fact that they have that moment is doing something.
Well, totally. And this is the thing, is that there is such, like, okay, you're going to reboot Roseanne, whatever. There is an opportunity to talk about working class life in America today. Like, white working class life, right?
Yes.
Right? Specifically.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. And what that looks like. And it does look like rationing medicine. It does look like your kids moving back home.
Yes.
It does look like not having fucking jobs.
That's
right?
what I'm saying.
And, like, and that is interesting. And, like, you could even say, look, we're going to make a show that, like, this is what you were getting at, right? Where you're like, well, why do these people support Trump and have a conversation around it and, like, actually dive into it and then, like, twist it around and do something really meaty with it? This show is not going to do that. Roseanne is a fucking whack job as a human being in the world, right? Like, she's trying to do this centrist bullshit instead of trying to push boundaries.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you 100%. I think our only disagreement is that I think it's really well done, really well constructed, really kind of funny, and that to me makes it more dangerous and more damaging, because I totally understand why people are responding to the show with warm feelings and I see that scene of them rationing the medicine and my heart kind of breaks for them because, like, you shouldn't fucking have to do this in America in 2018. You shouldn't fucking have to, but. The idea that the show dismisses, you know, there's the joke, quote unquote joke of, you know, Roseanne just dismisses the idea of, like, a better healthcare system to Jackie by saying, like, you can't do simple math. Oh, and it's like, no, that's fucking bullshit. Yeah. Of course we could have a much better healthcare system in this country, but you were not going to get it with fucking Trump. And look, I fucking get that Hillary Clinton would not, I understand that Hillary Clinton would not be an attractive, the Democratic, mainstream Democratic Party has been selling out, you know, working class people for decades, right? I get it, but that you cannot let people off the hook for voting for a white supremacist, you know, who is pushing through all kinds of restrictions against trans people and so on and so on. Like, you have to confront these people with that.
And that's the problem, too, is that Jackie has always been, like, a sort of wacky side character on the show. And you never identify with Jackie.
Her opinions are always supposed to be like, oh, that's just silly Jackie.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And I also, I was really uncomfortable with the extended pain to the arm forces during the family grace moment.
I
watched Roseanne a bit when it was first run, but I don't remember these periods of, like, the family saying grace, like, extensive grace and, like, praying over things. And so then to have them praying for the troops specifically, you know, I was like, okay, there's something going on here. specifically because is it DJ, you know, has been back from Syria for, like, 3 months, we're told, right? And the granddaughter, the black granddaughter that everybody's like, who the fuck is this child and how does she end up in that house? Apparently, that's his daughter. So I'm like, okay, what's going on there? Because his wife, we're told, is still deployed. Is his wife black? Was that her child? Did they adopt this baby? I need some answers. I don't want to watch the show for those answers, but I need some answers.
So, I'm going to link an article from Rob Sheffield at Rolling Stone that I think does a nice job. I really liked how he explained why the comedy didn't work, like why the show didn't work in that way. I referenced earlier Roxane Gay wrote a piece in The New York Times. One thing I liked about what she wrote, even though I disagree on the show being funny, is that she mentions how in her book Bad Feminist, she talks about, like, how you can like shitty TV. And in this article, she's like, since then, I've been thinking more about that since years ago when she wrote the book, and how she's like, there's a line, and, like, we build these, we have to have these lines about what is acceptable and what isn't for ourselves. And I really appreciate that self-reflection from her, because that's something that when people ask me all the time about, you know, we talk about being critical of the media you love and blah, blah, blah. And my line of what I'm willing to put up with and what I'm not willing to put up with over time has gotten narrower and narrower because of, like, the things in the world because of my politics, because of what I'm willing to like accept as valuable, or even like even stuff that I want to passively ingest, right? Because we all know that like you can still have your brain turned on and watch media. You're still gonna like, I still watch TV and go, why doesn't my hair look like that? Right? Like,
oh my gosh.
I know. But like that, like I didn't think that 20 years ago, but I do now. Like over time, my media consumption has affected my self-image, right? And what I expect, you know, that's a dumb example, but like it's an easy example. So anyways, I really did appreciate that part of her article. Being self-reflective and being like, no, like she's like, I kind of enjoyed the show, but I'm not willing to do that. Like, I'm not willing to watch any more of it because it's got these horrible values.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask y'all a question about, I don't remember the name of Darlene's son.
Mark.
Okay. So I could be misreading this, but to me, it seemed as if the show, through the characters of, you know, his grandparents, Roseanne and Dan, they were very concerned about the way that he dressed and the way he presented himself, right? Mm-hmm. And they were allowed, excuse me, to take some comfort in the fact that he apparently is not gay and that he's not trans, right? So he's just a boy who still likes knives and likes to play basketball. Likes these safely, you know, masculine in quotation marks kinds of things.
And so
did it seem as if, you know, like there was a way in which they wanted to, you know, have this kind of like grandstanding moment, but it was important for the show that, you know, hey, just so you know, the kid, like, he isn't actually gay. He isn't actually trans.
My feeling is that we do, but it's, that in a sense, it's also good to have representations of kids who are just gender non-conforming.
Totally.
You know, so I don't know. Like, I didn't necessarily read Roseanne asking Mark, like, do you feel like a boy or a girl, as, like, her being like, please say you're a boy. Just more like just wanting to understand. But so I was sort of like, oh, you know, cool. Like, the show is saying that, hey, just because a child who's, you know, been assigned male at birth and still identifies as male wants to express themselves in these, you know, quote unquote feminine ways, like, doesn't necessarily equate to them being trans. Like, I think that that's valuable.
Yeah.
But
I struggled with it, too, because, like, I really don't want to give the show any credit because I'm so angry at its existence. But, like, Dan at the end, like, because Dan's trying to be like, oh my God, he's going to get beat up. And at the end, when Mark was like, I'm going to do what I want to do and I'm going to deal with the consequences of it because this is right, Dan was like, wow, you're really brave. Right. And like that kind of turned me a little bit on the storyline. But also, like, so Dan, the man's man, Dan, recognized that bravery takes many different forms, right? And courage takes different forms. And I think that there was, like, that was the one moment in the show that I was like, oh.
Well, like, I see what you're saying there. And yeah, I agree, Caro, that, like, you know, the idea that, you know, that there should be, you know, like a range of gender expressions that are available for people is fantastic. As I guess I just didn't feel like the rest of the show, you know, was sophisticated enough, you know, like I just didn't give any credit. But I did like how when Dan initially expresses his discomfort with the way Mark is dressing, Darlene says, you let me dress like a little tomboy, right? Yeah. And I was like, yes, let's get into it, the ways in which, you know, like young girls and young boys are treated differently in terms of their gender presentation, right? And what's available to them. Like, I did actually think that was great. And in fact, the moment when the one moment that I did enjoy completely, unironically, was a moment when Darlene is sitting with Roseanne on the couch and she's crying, you know, like kind of after the revelation that her life didn't go the way that she wanted it to. And that was just felt like a real, you know, heart-filled moment that I was glad for. And that's what I remember, like, of the few things that I take from the original run of Roseanne, the things that I remember were those moments of, like, real emotion where, like, you felt like this family was connecting.
Who wants to go first for freakouts?
I'll go first.
All right. What is your freakout this week, Carol?
So this past Wednesday, the sixth and final season of a television show called The Americans premiered. The Americans has been one of my absolute favorite shows for as long as it's aired. It's in my so it's the basic premise is that it's about a married a couple and their children. You know, they're Russian spies living in deep cover. You know, as an quote unquote ordinary American family in the 1980s in the U.S. And it's Carrie Russell Matthew Reese as Philip. And you know, it involves a lot of like spycraft stuff, but at its heart, it's really a show about a marriage. It's a show about trust. It's a show about working through conflict. It's really a very, in my mind, insightful show about relationships and, you know, and love. And the premiere of season 6 was excellent. The show seems to be starting off this final season on such a confident foot because it sets up a conflict that is so kind of harrowing and so just horrifying in the potential consequences that it lays out for Philip and Elizabeth, these characters that we've really grown to love, you know, and care and, you know, and care about over the course of the show. But the show does not like play up the conflict or the drama in some like big, you know, big like TV way. It doesn't like sensationalize it or make a big deal out of it. It's so subtle. The show just lets it sit there, and, you know, so that you kind of feel it in the pit of your stomach, and the faces of these characters say so much. I mean, Carrie Russell, her character Elizabeth, is put into a situation that's so horrifying, and you just see it on her face. You just see this character being run ragged, just being like pushed to the absolute limit of what she can take and deal with internally. And so I'm simultaneously really looking forward to and kind of in a way dreading this final season of The Americans.
Cool.
Wow. I feel like that was a real bold, brave choice, Caro, to come on and talk about a show like that when you know that Anita and I don't like talking about relationships.
I watched like the first maturity. 3 seasons of The Americans.
Sure, Anita.
Thanks,
sure,
Ebony. Anita. Thanks, Ebony. I mean, somebody's got to, you
four?
Know, have
I
that kind of
four seasons.
Depth of, you know, on this podcast. Somebody's got to be able to appreciate that stuff.
My freak out this week is related to what we're going to talk about in the bonus. So if you are not a drip backer eligible to listen to our bonuses, you want to sign up this week. but I went on kind of a late 70s, early 80s horror kick related to some stuff I wanted to kind of unpack regarding the things that gets left out of Ready Player One. And so I watched a movie called Prom Night, starring Jamie Lee Curtis, came out in 1980, because I'm really interested in the kind of thematic choices that were made in teen-oriented horror films of the era, specifically like babysitting, malls, and proms. Like those three things, I'm super interested in the ways that like they kept appearing. And I don't know, like for instance, like malls are disappearing from America, right? So I think it's very rare that you get that as like a setting in horror films or any films today. But so I was checking out Prom Night. It's available to stream for free on Amazon. You know, I would never steer you wrong by making you rent something this terrible. And this movie is absolutely terrible. It has my absolute favorite trope, which is people who are a smooth 35 years old playing high schoolers. And people being like, I can't believe it's my 16th birthday. And you're like, you should be signing up for the AARP because you look so old. It is so just, but please get into Prom Night. There, it has a line that just blew my mind when someone, and remember, this movie comes out in 1980, and they're searching for this killer, and someone says, oh, God, it shouldn't, you know, it's going to be too hard to find a beat up VW. And I'm like, in 1980, I feel like every third car was a beat up VW bug, but whatever. It has Jamie Lee Curtis dancing. It has a creepy groundskeeper. It has everything you want from a horror movie coming out in 1980. Check it out. Prom night.
All right. My freak out is Netflix's documentary series, Ugly Delicious. It is a new food series that is starring David Chang, who, if you know food stuff, is the guy who runs Momofuku, which if you are, he has several restaurants, but in New York, the Momofuku noodle bar, you can go in and you can pay $150 and get a humongous, the biggest mountain of Korean fried chicken. Ooh. And it is fucking amazing. Like, get six people together and go do that shit, because yes. Anyways, it is directed by Morgan Neville, who I wasn't familiar with him before, but I guess he's award winning and has done a bunch of stuff. And I think he's doing the new Will You Be My Neighbor? Won't You Be My Neighbor?
Oh, right. The Mr. Rogers.
Yeah, Mr. Rogers documentary.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't think I've talked much about food stuff on the podcast. I'm sort of obsessed with food stuff. That's my little thing that I'm obsessed with. I love food documentaries and everything about it. This documentary series is making me so happy. Like, I can't, I'm like talking to the TV. I have like this huge grin on my face. Like, last night I watched the episode about barbecue and I just like, my eyes lit up the whole time watching like them roast these whole pigs, and like, it just, oh my God. So the thing about it is that like, it is, not only is it like interesting in terms of what it's doing, but it's a really, really well-made documentary. Like, if you're interested in filmmaking and documentary making, the way that they tell the narratives of food experiences and culture, I think is done so, so well. And you know, David Chang is kind of a tool, right? Like, the thing that's frustrating to me is that like, so chef culture is a culture of like abuse, really, right? Like, these dudes are just like kind of assholes and really aggressive and dominant, and it's very, very male dominated. And within this series, it's all dudes, right? Like, there's very, very few women, and that's unfortunate. Like, the women you do see are like the wives and the mothers and stuff like that. One thing I appreciate is that they do. Food is so political, right? And like, that is one of the things that I also love about food. It's cultural, it's political, it brings people together. And they don't shy away from that in this series. So in the episode about tacos, for example, like, they're talking about undocumented workers in America. Like, you can't talk about Mexican food without acknowledging that. And I think that that's really valuable. The other thing that I think that Chang brings a lot to almost every episode is like, why are things how they are? Why is tradition how tradition is? Why can't we mix things up? Why aren't we changing things? You know, he's coming from this perspective of a Korean American, and like doing these, I don't want to say mixing up like, you know, this culture's food and this culture's food, and how does that work together, and what ways these different types of food are similar. So like, the barbecue episode was like, well, why is barbecue like American barbecue? Why isn't like Peking duck also considered barbecue, because it's cooking on an open flame, right? And I really like the challenging of that, and bringing in the voices of the people who are traditionalists and the people who aren't. One thing I want to say that I like, I almost had tears while I was watching it. So I'm real serious about this shit, y'all. There is a taco truck in LA that is Arabic tacos, and what? I lost my shit. But hold on, it gets better. So not only was I like, oh my God, my people plus tacos, what could possibly make me happier in life?
Right.
There is a place in Mexico called, are you ready? It's called Baghdad Tacos.
Ooh.
Yeah. And not only is it like bringing, it's been there for a long time. And not only is it bringing like Iraqi tradition into like traditional Mexican taco making, but also they talked about the Armenian genocide.
Wow.
Like, it was in passing. I was just like, I was losing my shit. I need to go to this place and try these tacos and meet these people. So like,
road trip.
Yeah, right? I'm not finished with the series yet, but I really, really like it a lot and highly recommend it if you're into that kind of into food culture and et cetera, et cetera. So That's our show. You can catch us back here every single Wednesday. We could not make this podcast happen without our generous backers on Drip. Drip is Kickstarter's brand new subscription-based crowdfunding platform. Help us keep bringing this podcast to you every week by joining the FemFreak community. We've even got some great rewards for you, so pitch in now at d.rip/FemFreak. If you're enjoying the show, we have a small favor to ask. Please leave us a review on iTunes because it really helps us spread the word about the show. And, you know, tell all of your friends when you're freaking out in the movie theater about how fucking awful Ready Player One is. Woo! You can check out all of our work and our other podcasts at feministfrequency.com. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at FemFreak to stay up to date on all of our latest news. And we always want to hear from you, so hit us up on Twitter. Carol, where are you at?
I'm at Carolyn Michelle.
Ebony?
I am at Half Price Easter Candy.
Mm-hmm. And I am at Anita Sarkeesian. Our producer is Phil Circus, who also composed our theme music. And we'll see you all next week.
Bye. Later.